So we have two sounds. We have the singing of the medicine bowl, and we also have the singing of the wheezing dog. So you can take your pick on what you'd like to focus on, or both, stereo hearing. Towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. So as we say the Sufi invocation, we cup our hands in a receptive mode near the heart. And as we're pronouncing, invoking, saying this beautiful invocation, we are imagining this, God willing, empty chalice is coming to be filled, and joined with all the masters, saints, and prophets. And then we give this gesture of taking our hands, raising them up, and pouring them gently over our heads and down through the sides of our beings as a bestowal of blessings of all the illuminated souls. And so you will find the same gesture at the closing of prayer, the same bestowal of blessing. Those of you that have received an initiation know that this same gesture is given as a blessing during the initiation process. And one can think of it in that way. That blessing coming again and again. Shahabuddin Sawardi said, "You will recognize them by the cloak of light that they wear." And so as we make this gesture, we're becoming aware of being bathed in this light, enlivening this cloak of light. And at the beginning of class, let us make a further invocation with prayer Salat. Most gracious Lord, Master, Messiah, and Savior of humanity, we greet thee in all humility. Thou art the first cause and the last effect, Alpha and Omega. Thy light is in all forms, thy love in all beings. In a loving mother, in a kind father, in an innocent child, in a helpful friend, and an inspiring teacher. Allow us to recognize thee in all thy holy names and forms, as Rama, as Krishna, as Shiva, as Buddha. Let us know thee as Abraham, as Solomon, as Zarathustra, as Moses, as Jesus, as Muhammad, and in many other names and forms known and unknown to the world. We adore thy past. Thy presence deeply enlightens our being, and we look for thy blessing in the future. O Messenger, Christ, Nabi, the Rasul of God, thou whose heart constantly reaches upward, thou comest on earth with a message as a dove from above, when Dharma decayeth, and speakest the word that is put into thy mouth as the light filleth the crescent moon. May the star of the divine light shining in thy heart be reflected in the hearts of thy devotees. May the message of God reach far and wide, illuminating and making the whole of humanity as one single brotherhood in the fatherhood of God. So we invoke and we invite the holy presence of all the illuminated beings and the masters, saints, and prophets. And we ask that they are here with us, guiding us in these moments. And in our lives. We've been going over for a number of months, maybe the last 10 months, a series of teachings that have to do with the training of the ego. And I thought I would read something about the natural self, which I think is such an interesting ideal to reflect on, because I guess it's a good question for us to ask, what is our natural self? When are we our natural selves? How do we look? How do we feel? How do we act? How are we being when we're our natural self? And I'm reading from a text here that's called The Inner School, Esoteric Sufi Teachings by Hidayat Inayat Khan. And this is the subject, the natural self. It is very necessary in the life of an adept on the spiritual path to adopt body, mind, and heart appropriately. Let me read that again. I didn't read it quite accurately. It is very necessary in the life of an adept on the spiritual path to adapt, not adopt, to adapt body, mind, and heart appropriately. Concentration, meditation, and other practices all help the spirit to rediscover its natural condition, its original self. However great the musician, if the musical instrument is not in tune, not in its natural condition, the player is unable to express the beauty of the music as he or she would wish. Therefore, to become spiritual means to purify the spirit so that it discovers its natural self, which then may be expressed within the vehicles of body, mind, and heart. Inasmuch as these reflect divine light, they become together the sacred temple of God. Therefore, to become spiritual means to purify the spirit so that it discovers its natural self, which then may be expressed within the vehicles of body, mind, and heart. And so this highlights very beautifully the significance of the purification breaths, which, you know, I really always like to begin the classes with that practice, because in some ways it can help us slough off the layers or the dust on the lantern, the dust on the mirror, to get to that natural self, that natural vibration. And so very simply, the practice begins with breathing out and then breathing in and out the nose, in and out the nose in a natural rhythmic pattern. However, the breath becomes slightly fuller and more purposeful than normal. One is mindful and putting one's awareness on the breath. And the breath is in the up and out the nose. And the phrase that we concentrate on while inhaling is, I inhale divine light and life. And when we breathe out, I radiate divine life and light. And here, while we're breathing, if we can think of it as participating in the light and the life of the whole universe as we draw that breath in. Yes, we're breathing, but we're also being breathed, and we are participating with this universal breath, inhaling and exhaling. And as we breathe in, we become receptive and absorb through all of space light and life. And as we breathe out, we radiate and offer back with full hearts and generosity this life and light and love to the whole universe without discrimination, without preference. Inhale. inhale divine light and life, I radiate divine light and light. We breathe in the nose and out the mouth, and we contemplate the same phrase, but what's more, we contemplate the nature of that breath, and we concentrate on that phrase. I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. In the nose and out the mouth. And in the nose and out the mouth. And the breath takes another turn as we breathe in through the mouth and out through the nose while continuing to contemplate this phrase. I inhale divine light and life. And as we breathe out, I radiate divine life and light. And again, we're breathing in through the mouth and we are exhaling through the nose. The last breath, we will breathe in through the mouth and out through the mouth. We inhale through the mouth and we exhale through the mouth. While repeating the phrase, I inhale divine light and life, I radiate divine life and life. interesting to contemplate in your individual practice these directions that the breath is moving. It's also interesting for us to remember that Murshida Nayak Khan came from an Eastern culture. He didn't get into a lot of scientific or detailed explanations about these directions, but one could study them very deeply within one's own practice, keeping in mind of the medicinal qualities that these breaths can offer at all different levels of one's being. Also being aware that within the Eastern traditions, medicine is studied and practiced in very different ways, at much more subtle levels of the being. And so it deals with the various channels and pathways, both gross and subtle, within our being. And one might contemplate how these breaths maybe correspond to that also. I won't say more, but study it deeply from your own experience. And always remember that, again, these teachings have come to us from the East. And here we are, Western mind, studying them. What does that mean? And how can we more and more tune to the teachings? You know, in the East, one would never consider speaking to an elder or to someone in a respected position ever before being spoken to first. It's not done. And so when we think about that in relationship to these teachings of the ego, we might also contemplate Murshid's perspective having come from that Eastern tradition, that teaches us this subtlety and culture of manner. I think sometimes in the West we take a consumerism attitude even towards our spirituality. And so we will invite the spirit of Murshid in to help illuminate these teachings even further. He tells us, and just as a review, because we didn't meet in this way last month, we had a class and a retreat dealing on another entirely different subject. So we're kind of reconstituting ourselves here, and I'd like to reflect back on the previous teaching that we heard while we were together, and I'll just read a little piece of that to kind of orient us for this next teaching. Just to reflect on what I said further, it's interesting when you think about it, isn't it? This kind of patience that can be developed in one's being while sitting maybe in the discomfort of silence waiting to be spoken to. Can you imagine that? Murshid talks about his own teacher. He had been with his teacher for more than 6 months and waiting for some literal words of quote-unquote teachings to come. And when the teacher finally started to give a dissertation on spirituality, Murshid took out a pencil and a pad and he stopped talking. But you see, not everything's given in words. That was a big lesson for Murshid, that sometimes developing keen observation and observing the manner of the teacher is as much a teaching as anything else. Again, not needing to have the words, but absorbing atmosphere. It's very important. So we invoke his atmosphere and everything that he learned along the way, he being our Murshidan icon, our pure Murshid. So we continue again with this subject of training the ego that we find in the gathas. And last time we gathered, we listened to the teachings on training of the ego, the three parts of the ego. And it's good to again reflect on this to segue into our teaching of this month. The ego is divided into three parts: the physical ego, the mental ego, and the spiritual ego. The mental ego covers the spiritual ego, and the physical ego is a cover over the mental ego. The ego indeed is one, but these are three different aspects of the ego. The physical ego is nourished by the gratification of the bodily appetites. One sees that after a meal or some refreshing drink of sort, there is a sort of feeling of stimulation that arises, and no doubt it covers with an additional cover of I within. Therefore, there is a difference between sleep and meditation. People often say, oh, sometimes it's very hard to do my practices. I always say, get up a little bit earlier. Start your day like that. Don't try to fit it in otherwise. And here Murshid says, and there is a difference between sleep and meditation. Although both produce rest, yet one rest is caused by stimulation of the body, and the other rest comes from without it. There have been some cases of meditative people sleeping only 1 or 2 hours out of the 24 without becoming ill. A person who can sleep well shows the sign of health and yet is subject to any illness. The gratification of every appetite is a momentary stimulation and rest to the body. But this momentary satisfaction creates a further appetite. And every experience in the satisfaction of the appetites gives a desire for more satisfaction. In America, we have that commercial for potato chips, Lay's potato chips. It says, bet you can't eat just one. It's kind of like that. You know, if you take a taste of something you like really well, it's really hard to stop at that one little thing. And one could say that of many things dealing with the body and stimulation of the body. Thus, the ego covers over one's mental and spiritual being, and it becomes thicker and thicker until it closes all light from within. And so again, in the American vernacular, we say, oh, that person's so dense, right? I mean, that's just kind of slang for meaning, well, we could say they're slow-witted in some way, but also they can be lacking in a consciousness. We can use it in that way. So we hear that even in our common language. There are some who eat in order to live, but there are many who live in order to eat. Bless you. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. But if the whole life be devoted to the instrument, then the person for whom the instrument exists is deprived of his experience in life. The The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. It's a very interesting and full statement there. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. So we think of this vehicle, this body, as being that container for this soul, that individuated self that comes to experience this external world. But if the whole life is devoted to the instrument, then the person for whom the instrument exists is deprived of his experience in life. And I love the metaphor, as some of you maybe have had the opportunity to participate in the or to witness a puja, or a prayer service from the East. And in that service, one of the things that's done is a coconut is taken and crushed. And if you think about that, here's the beautiful metaphor. Mercer talks about the physical covers the mental, and the mental covers the spiritual. It's the same with the coconut. Think about that hard, brown, hairy outside of that coconut. Or even think about from the time it's forming. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to observe that in nature. The little nugget starts to form. It's very bright green, and as it gets bigger and bigger, like us ourselves, as we grow up, as we mature, what happens? That hard brown shell, that hairy hard brown shell, can start to cover us up. But when you shake inside, what's inside? That beautiful, clear milk of the coconut, right? So this is part of the service in these suits. So bang, bang, bang. They're cracking that coconut on a rock to crack open the ego. And what's underneath that brown covering is what? That beautiful, white, sweet flesh. The mental. It's pliable. You know, it can be very sweet. And inside, what's inside? That beautiful, sweet coconut milk. This is a good metaphor to think of ourselves in being this way. And then we whine and cry about life. Oh, boo-hoo. Someone was mean to me. Someone was bad to me. Someone said something not nice to me. Oh, I wish I was this way. Well, guess what? It's your coconut getting cracked on the rock of truth. And if one can take every blow in that way, one can really accomplish something. So I wanted to offer this as a metaphor and to realize that some of these things that happen to us can in truth soften us, can crack open that hard shell if we allow it. It's a matter of perspective. Well, and it's a matter of choice. It's a matter of choice to take it as a learning experience or to make ourselves all the more miserable over it. And Mercer talks a lot about that, how we live in the realm of God. Are there any comments about what I've said before I move on, or questions? You all have a pretty good understanding of this metaphor and how it relates to the teaching.
It's a good metaphor.
It's a great metaphor. And I've seen it done so many times. And sometimes those coconuts are just their outer shell so stubborn. They're just, I've seen people, you know, just in the service, just bang, bang, bang. And you know, it's sometime like that, you know, with our practice too. You know, you wonder if we're not beating our heads against something. But in truth, in a way, we are. You know, it's that shell of that ego. And we do construct that, you know. And sometimes it's constructed as a defense. And sometimes, you know, it's necessary. But on the spiritual path, we are trying to train that ego to not be so undisciplined. And reactionary, you might say. You understand?
comments or questions?
It's interesting how the hard shell has a function, but perhaps it can outlive its function and become a hindrance.
Yeah, if you want to get to that sweet part, it does, doesn't it?
Stephanie, what does idea about the good dying early mean? That the good are so tender and sweet that they can't stand the mean, harsh world?
I don't think so. No, because we only see it from the perspective of that soul. But if you look at it from the perspective that everything is interconnected, that soul could have had a very big purpose in all the other beings that it touched, even if it was for that short period of time. And that birth and death could be an incredible blessing and teaching. And so I think we do often get limited because we don't realize that things are some sort of continuum. I think we get we have judgments about birth and suffering and death, but from other perspectives there can be great value in that, and we can be extremely mindful. And from, you know, it depends on what tradition you're coming from, but I love the saying, only the good die young. I'm going to probably live to be about 300 years old.
Great.
You know? But I also think there is something wonderful about that phrase, that there's that sweet tenderness too. And so we can't say, because each soul has their own purpose and function.
Thank you.
And we're somewhat limited in our perspective, perhaps. You're welcome. Anything else? Any other comments or questions? So the next section is on, and again I'm reading from the Gathas, number 10, the training of the egos continued. And here Mercia talks about the three stages. Before he talked about the three parts of the ego, and now he's talking about the three stages through which the ego develops. There are three different stages through which the ego develops and reaches the ideal state. The ideal state, and you know, it calls to mind again that beautiful teaching, shatter your ideal on the rock of truth. Shatter your ideal on the rock of truth, because in a way, and it's about not bringing false idols too, you know, that we make these idols. I like to say also, shatter your idols on the rock of truth. You know, that these idols that we make out of relationships or other people or circumstances or even of the teachings can become an idol, but is it a true ideal? You know, and is it really mapping onto a larger principle of truth or just that small truth of our own sort of limited view and vision? And we know that as we mature spiritually, that those perspectives, those ideals change, and often our view becomes much broader, not so limited. And so we can witness that within our own development. So again, there are three different stages through which the ego develops and reaches the ideal state. The first stage is called Amara by Sufis. And in this, the ego is satisfied by the satisfaction of passions and appetites. Passions and appetites. So here we could again liken that to the physical state, where we have passions can be these emotional states, and also appetites of all different levels, both physical appetites, but things that bring stimulation to the body. From this animal stage, the ego may rise to a higher stage, which is man's ego, and that stage is the gratification of vanity. This ego is termed by the Sufi Lawama, and this stage in the beginning causes a person to act in every way that is likely to cause harm and to be hurtful and unjust to others. It's interesting, huh? This continues until he learns to understand the true nature of vanity. Since all good as well as all evil is born of vanity. Again, I think last time we spoke of this, I talked about that expression we have, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. When vanity ceases to cause man to do evil, he has reached the human stage. And Mercer talks about this, and there are other traditions as well, that say that the human stage is the highest stage of realization. Because it is there that we can study the teachings, we can actualize the teachings, we can practice the teachings, and we can perfect the teachings. But when vanity causes man to do good, the ego becomes humane. Not just human, but humane. Using this word in the Oriental sense, again, Murshid highlights the point that this is coming, these teachings come from Eastern tradition, Oriental tradition, in which it means more than human, as it is derived from the two words hu, H-U, meaning divine, and manas, mind, the divine mind. Like bodhicitta in Tibetan Buddhism. Yes. Whoever is asking the question, if they want to unmute and ask the question, they're invited to do that. So they can type it. If I could just say it, it's a quick question from Petra Alima. Could you give another word for vanity? Well, I'm going to read in a minute Murshid's description of that, and then maybe we can revisit the question, but let's see if it's clarified. Is that all right? Yes, wait, I'm having something else dropped. So this was from the same body of teachings. As a reminder, we're currently on number 10. I have read from number 9, but this is from number 8. And this is on training of the ego on the subject of vanity. Man has the desire to do good and to refrain from doing evil, because to do so feeds his vanity. Among 1,000 good and virtuous people, there is scarcely one who does good and refrains from evil, because that is his natural inclination. So here we could almost think about it as reflecting on childhood. You know, sometimes we are the ego or even the vanity of ownership, you know, or entitlement. I have this toy and you don't. Children will do that to each other. I have these new shoes and your shoes are dirty. I look a certain way and you don't. You see, that's a reflection of that kind of vanity. And often we have to teach children that things hurt another person. So here Murshid's saying, not everyone has the natural inclination. Sometimes we have to take a child aside and say, you know, maybe there's reasons that someone can't have those things that are that way. And you're fortunate, and it's not it's not nice to hurt someone's feelings. You know, we learn that sometimes. Not everyone's born with that natural inclination of consideration. And in truth, that's developmentally correct for the species. That's how the species survives. In a way, it's Darwinism. One could even call it social Darwinism. And there's something programmed in us from an animalistic point of view, which relates now to lesson 10, that we do these things in order to survive as a species. But if we are to elevate ourselves beyond survival into a more, as Murshid said, humane state, then we come to learn these things either through proper parenting, but not always it comes in that way. Sometimes, in fact, our own parents could have treated us in this way. And then what? There's something in us that searches for that, unless we become sociopathic psycho killers, which none of us are, I hope. I don't think you are. But you know what I'm saying. I make a joke here, but the truth is that there's something in us that is always searching for that. And if we don't get it early on, we search for it, and we come into communities like this, where we hear someone say something and it touches us deeply, and we want to search more. Does that make sense? The majority of those engaged in art, science, religion, or politics are conscious all the time of the opinion of others, and they can only work upon the lines they are following if appreciation comes from some quarter. The least antagonism or opposition discourages them and often kills their desire. I've said this even to my college students, trying to instill in them some, and I say this to you as spiritual beings, you know, of what use is it to really just follow examples that have already been given? Of course, we want to follow examples like Buddha, Jesus gave us, and all the great masters, saints, and prophets. But when we are trying to really offer something, and here now I'm speaking of artists, politicians, writers, and so forth, the great ones, the really great ones that changed the way we saw or thought or heard were the ones that went counter to what the norm was at the time, the really great beings. And I often say that to my students, be revolutionaries. And I remember time and time again, my friend, and I consider her a teacher and mentor, Karuna Maima, from Sri Aurobindo Ashram, crying out, she taught me that phrase, Inqilab Zindabad, Inqilab Zindabad, Inqilab Zindabad. And that was the cry that got India her independence out of the stronghold of the British Empire. Revolution now! Not later, not waiting for someone, not someone helping us, not someone saying you are enlightened, doing it, taking up the task ourselves. And she uses it as spiritual revolution now. Inqilab Zindabad. You can look it up. It's in Wikipedia. So again, a majority of those engaged in art, science, religion, or politics are conscious all the time of the opinion of others, and they can only work upon the lines they are following if appreciation comes from some quarter. The least antagonism or opposition discourages them and often kills their desire. Among thousands, there's one great soul that can keep firm and strong in his purpose, in her purpose, through life, unshaken and unweakened by opposition from any side. It is the person who wins in the end and accomplishes things that are worthwhile. Among thousands, it is one great soul that can keep firm and strong in his, in her purpose through life, unshaken and unweakened by opposition from any side. It is that person who wins in the end and accomplishes things that are worthwhile. You know, people are pretty fickle. And their opinions also are. So I don't rely too much on that myself. Because that's bound to change. And if we're constantly waiting for that external recognition, feedback, acknowledgement, pat on the back, it can come in one moment, and the next moment that same person is in a bad mood and they take it away. Then what happens? It's conditional. Unconditional. I remember one time being on a retreat with Pure Vilayat, and I was in the Swiss mountains, and it came very strongly during that retreat. I'll share this with you. If you don't ever remember anything else I ever say to you, remember this. These were the words that came. It was like this universal voice spoke. Build the sanctuary within. Build the sanctuary within. Build the sanctuary within. Back to this month's lesson. The first lesson that the ego must learn in order to develop into the humane state is that of pride in the form of self-respect. Pride in the form of self-respect. So Mersha tells us that this outer physical state is that vehicle for the soul to experience this external world. If that is true, giving self-respect to the vehicle, giving it proper food, proper clothing, proper bathing, proper rest, self-respect, then also with the emotions, also with the internal training. As man has the inclination to have good clothes and good ornaments in order to appear in the eyes of others as what he considers beautiful, so he must feel the same inclination towards building the personality by the ornamentation of every action and manner in the way that he considers good and beautiful. The first lesson that the ego must learn in order to develop its humane state is that of pride in the form of self-respect. As man has the inclination to have good clothes and good ornaments in order to appear in the eyes of others as what he considers beautiful, so he must feel the same inclination towards the building of personality by the ornamentation of every action and manner in the way that he considers good and beautiful. Any comments or questions? it's beautiful to think of that. I love the Buddhist prayer, the seven-limb prayer. I'll say the entire prayer and then I'll highlight the one line that relates to this idea of pride and self-respect. The prayer goes like this. I take refuge in my Lama, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Noble Sangha. By practicing the six perfections in the way of the Bodhisattva, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of the world. I make offerings of every type, actually offered and mentally transformed. I confess all my sins from beginningless time. I rejoice in the virtuous deeds of ordinary and special beings. Please remain until samsara ends. Speaking the words of Dharma, turning the world of samsara, cyclic existence, as I ask, as I request, for the benefit of all sentient beings. So the line that says, I rejoice in the virtuous deeds of ordinary and special beings, one has to ask oneself, do we? I find bad news travels fast, good news rarely travels. I mean, when we see someone in our workplace getting acknowledged for something, or we hear someone being complimented, or we see someone coming into a position of favoritism, how do we really feel? Do we rejoice? I rejoice in the virtuous deeds of ordinary and special beings. So, this idea that feeling this great pleasure in Sanskrit it would be called mudita, sympathetic joy, for when someone does something good or is recognized. But what's really also hard is when someone's recognized for your own good deeds. And that often happens too. But we also know that from our teachings in Buddhism, the 8 verses on training the mind, to offer all victory to others, taking nothing for ourselves. Offer all victory to others.
Doesn't Merchant say to downplay your own and highlight achievements of others?
I don't remember that quote especially, but it sounds
something along those lines.
Well, I think that he says that especially in regard to one's faults in reverse. Mm-hmm. That we actually take ourselves to task and really contemplate deeply our own faults before blaming another. That I remember. But it's very likely that
that's what I was referring to, I think.
Or, yes. Yeah. And there's another Lojong training, or training, the phrases for training the mind where it talks about, in fact, I think that's the one you have upstairs, drive all blame into oneself. I mean, if someone comes to you and they want to blame you for something, and you just say, you're right, I'm sorry, the conversation's over. At that point, it's done. But if instead we say, but I this and that and blah, 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 it's not going to be over for a long time. So just, yeah, I could do best.
Stephanie,
thank you.
When I was here last time, I had parked so not to block the driveway from the lady across the street.
Yes.
Very close. But I know I didn't hit her car. And yet she came out ravagingly angry when I was leaving. Does she do that with everyone?
No.
And she threatened to call the police, and I didn't bother to get out and look because I knew I had done nothing. I just drove off and didn't give her the time of day. But that wasn't nice of me. I should have been a little sweeter. you know.
That's nice that you reflect on that.
Well, it reminds me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, maybe if you see them, you can be
I
sure
to check. Park near there.
Yeah, right. That's best.
Because I asked the policeman later. I saw that day when she threatened to call the police, and he said they wouldn't take any report unless she went in person to make a report. She was rabid. She, poor darling,
probably
miserable.
Something else going on.
Of course,
you know
there
that's
was.
Often
she's
got to
have a friend to badger.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just FYI, the young woman across the street dates a policeman, so we might want to be careful.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for the warning. It's probably her daughter.
I get me. Any other comments or questions before we to do a practice now?
I was wondering if we got the question of the sky.
The vanity?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm wondering if it's been answered. I mean, vanity can't be described really in one word. Another one word.
Yes.
Is it clear?